In Peter Carrington, we are celebrating the life of a great statesman and a truly remarkable character. When, some years ago, he honored me by asking me to give this address, he said, "You've got 10 minutes." The last time I saw him, he reduced it to 2 minutes. I can sense him looking over my shoulder now, telling me not to overdo it. Like so many others of his generation, his wartime experience influenced very deeply Peter's approach to life afterwards. He showed great courage as he led his tank squadron to secure Nijmegen Bridge in the Battle of Arnhem. It was a very tricky, chaotic, and dangerous operation as they met stiff resistance from the Germans. With his usual understatement, Peter later described it as rather disagreeable. In similar fashion, he greeted his award of the MC as pot luck. It was his soldiers who impressed Peter. Typically, unlike other tank commanders, he hid a bottle of whiskey to share with his men as they faced that battle in Nijmegen. He commented, "You could not get a finer or better lot than they were. They deserved something better in the aftermath of the war." He wanted them to have greater opportunities, not overshadowed by poverty and hardship. Peter was by instinct a one-nation Tory. So he committed himself to public life, taking up his seat in the House of Lords in 1945 and devoting himself to the development of a more united country. As Peter was a landowner and supporter of the Country Landowners Association, it was not surprising that Churchill asked him to join, as he put it, his shoot as a junior minister for agriculture. Then, for the next half century, Peter played a massive and distinguished role in successive governments, spanning 6 prime ministers and 2 monarchs. What was it that gave Peter the ability to fulfill such an outstanding public service? His own family history prepared him for service. The Carrington family has contributed in many spheres of national life throughout the last 200 years. The inheritance of land, especially in Buckinghamshire, gave Peter deep roots in the countryside. It allowed him independence, wealth, and strength on which to base his public service. No doubt, noblesse oblige featured in his self-confidence, which was matched by absolute humility. Above all, it was his remarkably attractive character that enabled him to succeed so extensively. At the center of it was his love and interest in people, coupled with a unique sense of humor. People warmed to his presence, and he brought out the best in them. These qualities gave him great diplomatic skills and the ability to achieve consensus. After his early success as High Commissioner to Australia, a country he much loved, he served throughout the Cold War in ministerial roles in defense or foreign policy, ending up as Secretary General of NATO until just before the collapse of the Berlin Wall and the Soviet Union. He was always adamant that the West needed to maintain a strong conventional forces buttressed by a nuclear deterrent. He believed in the Atlantic Alliance and in a strong and natural relationship with the United States. Determined in his view that Europe must never again start a world war, he was in full support of the United Kingdom joining the common market in 1972. He also played a major part in helping to steer the dismantling of the British Empire and its development into the Commonwealth, following Macmillan's Wind of Change speech in South Africa. Peter was a pragmatic politician, able to get quickly to the heart of the matter, as illustrated in his economic use of words. He always saw the big picture and understood the great geopolitical shifts that affected our country, but without any sign of unreasonable nostalgia. The world enjoyed him as Foreign Secretary because to so many, he was the epitome of all that was best in British values. His greatest diplomatic achievement was to bring an end to the civil war in Rhodesia and negotiate the independence of Zimbabwe. His skill around the conference table at Lancaster House was phenomenal, using humour and firmness with Smith, Nkomo, Muzorewa, and Mugabe. He faced strong opposition amongst some Tory peers and charges of traitorship at the party conference that year. Failure would have ended his career. Success gave him a reputation as an outstanding political leader. At ministerial meetings as Foreign Secretary, he would use nicknames for world figures. It was often a struggle to work out who they were. One French foreign minister was known as the Dancing Master because he looked exactly like a ballroom dancer. Mugabe was spelled backwards as E. Bargum. A Danish prime minister was known as D.D., the dreaded Dane. Less well known were his limericks, often composed for some light relief at international meetings. All this meant that Peter was great fun to work with. He delegated to his junior ministers, praised them when they did well, and took the flak when they didn't. He was admired and respected by his civil servants and service chiefs. But all was underpinned by a distinctive and serious sense of public service and duty. In reviewing Peter's book, Reflect on Things Past, his great friend, Henry Kissinger, who is present today, said, "I have met many world leaders in the past 25 years. None have impressed me more than Lord Carrington." Referring to his deep sense of public duty, he concluded that he thought of him not as a foreign statesman from a friendly country, but as a colleague on the ramparts, defending the common values of the West. It is not surprising that in a long career, Peter faced difficult situations, including some which might have prompted his resignation. When it came to the Falklands, he concluded that irrespective of whether he could have prevented the war, the Franks report later suggested he could not, it was a political and foreign policy disaster. It was his job to carry the can and to resign. As he said later, "This was the most sorrowful moment of my life, but someone had to take responsibility. I only lost my job. Others lost their lives." That was the end of his political career. He knew he had done the right thing, but was deeply saddened and wounded in having to end the job he most wanted to do. He lost his job, but he lost it with honour. Of the six prime ministers he served, Peter particularly admired Harold Macmillan, and Macmillan described Peter as the last of the Whigs, full of common sense and a very good nerve. Peter had many sharp exchanges with Margaret Thatcher, but they developed a strong mutual respect. Margaret once said, "He was not to my way of thinking, but he has style, experience, wit, and a touch of class." Peter's beloved dogs were all named after former prime ministers and their spouses, from Clement and Arthur to Margaret Hilda and Edward. Occasionally, he would answer the telephone by announcing himself as Edward's uncle, thus challenging callers to decide quickly whether they had got the right number. His cows and rams were named, and the cowshed was known as Buckingham Palace. It has been suggested that Peter disliked the Conservative Party. I would put it differently. He accepted that a political party system was essential in a democracy, but the mechanisms of the party political system were to him a regrettable necessity. He did not enjoy being chairman of the Conservative Party. He was not alone in not enjoying party conferences. What Peter did love was the House of Lords, where he served for 73 years. He could tease it as a beloved member of the family. With tongue in cheek, he responded to Lord Salisbury's request for advice on becoming leader of the Lords. "You've got to remember, you are a headmaster of a second-rate public school." In the many tributes following Peter's death last summer, people consistently drew attention to his great humanity, his generosity, particularly to causes for young people. His humour and integrity, his humility and self-deprecation, and his special courtesy to people of all backgrounds and nationalities. He was full of common sense and kindness. He hated rudeness and was angry with anyone who treated badly those unable to defend themselves. He was never pompous. Time will not serve to tell of his manifold interests, ranging from music, arts, banking, and business, to his devotion to his garden. He thrived on responsibility and had a restless urge to get on with things. One politician described him as the most rounded man he knew. The key, however, to Peter's happiness and success in life was his marriage of 67 years to Iona. This he described as by far the most sensible thing I've ever done. It was truly magical to see their love and devotion to each other. Together, they moved after the war to Bledlow, where over the decades they created this wonderful 7-acre garden. Iona designed it and knew all the plants, prompting Peter's remark that she only spoke Latin. Iona described her role as to create an atmosphere of peace and serenity for Peter. This gave Peter the whole foundation for a happy and successful life. The toast at his golden wedding was prefaced by the remark, "You did awfully well." We all say hear, hear to that wonderful understatement. Peter was very lonely for 9 years after Iona's death, never showing self-pity, but deeply grateful to his children, Alexandra, Virginia, and Rupert, for their endless encouragement, support, and love. He would talk often to his friends about how the grandchildren and great-grandchildren were getting on. He was lucky to have such devoted and loyal staff who were with him to the very end. Many of us have witnessed on a clear night, the passing of a meteor across the sky, ending with a bright light. Peter's life was like a meteor, flashing across the sky, leaving a bright light that we shall always remember. In the words of Chaucer, he was a true, a perfect, gentle knight. We celebrate his life with gratitude.